Ladies and gentlemen, it's my privilege to welcome back to the Salier Report, Dr. Edwin Vieira. Dr. Vieira, for those who listened to our wonderful interview last year about constitutional conventions being a very bad idea, have been introduced. He also joined us in 2012 when The Sword and Sovereignty, his book that we're going to be talking about this evening, was first published. But he's the go-to person when I have questions of U.S. law and particularly the Constitution. He's been practicing for more than three decades. He has, and I forgive you for this, 4 degrees from Harvard University. And he's argued and briefed cases leading to landmark decisions before the U.S. Supreme Court. He is the author of a book I consider a must-have for anybody serious about monetary history. It's The Monetary Legal History of the U.S., Pieces of Eight, and it's quite an extraordinary volume. If you really want to understand U.S. monetary history, it's a must-have, Pieces of Eight. I recommend it to you strongly. And subsequent to publishing Pieces of Eight, he published Sword and Sovereignty, which is a complete and very thorough review on the history and legal issues of militias in the United States, something I think it's very important for all of us to know about. So, Dr. Vieira, thank you again for joining us on the Salier Report.
Well, thank you for giving me the opportunity to do so.
Well, first, why don't we start and explain why you wrote Sword and Sovereignty and what it is and mention how we get it.
Well, the impetus for it came well before 2012, came about the time of the 9/11 event. And I assumed after that had happened that there would be some upsurge in interest in general preparedness in the United States. And there wasn't. And what I would call the usual suspects, the people that I would have expected to begin talking about that problem, were remarkably silent. So I'd looked at it from a constitutional perspective, and of course from the constitutional perspective, the institutions that are required for that purpose are the militia of the several states. That's their title in the Constitution. And there was very little that had been done about that, certainly not recently. I mean, there are publications you can go back and find going all the way back into the 1900s. But the question was, why weren't those institutions up and running today? And so I began delving into the history of it, and it became apparent to me that the first thing that had to be laid out was the constitutional framework, constitutional principles of these institutions. Because, of course, they're mentioned in the Constitution, but the Constitution, not being a dictionary or an encyclopedia, doesn't really define what they are or point you in the particular direction. And that was a historical question, so I went back and I reviewed all of the colonial and state statutes, acts, ordinances, whatever they called them, from the beginning of the country, 1600s, on through the period of ratification of the Constitution. And it's from that that you can draw a pretty accurate picture of what these things are, at least in terms of principle. I put two of them, or the history of two of them, Virginia and Rhode Island, into this book, The Sword and Sovereignty. And the reason I picked those two was, first, I had to limit the amount of information that was going to go in that book. That book's over 2,000 pages long, just dealing with those two. So you can imagine how long it would have been if I'd done all 13. And they were basically the same.
Right.
In terms of the principles of the militia structures, and that was true of all of the 13 colonies and then independent states. But Rhode Island and Virginia were interesting because they were on the opposite ends of a number of spectra. Rhode Island was considered to be a very democratical, that was the word they used, very democratical colony, almost anarchic in comparison to the others. Virginia was an aristocratic colony. Rhode Island was very small. Virginia was one of the largest, if it wasn't the largest, of all the colonies. Rhode Island operated pretty much on the basis of coastal trade, and international trade, and seafaring people. Virginia was pretty much an agricultural colony. Virginia had an economy that was very much based upon the plantation system, slave plantation system. Rhode Island had quite a number of slaves, so all the colonies did, because slavery, of course, was legal during the 1600s and 1700s, but it was not primarily an agricultural colony based on that type of production. So there are all these differences. Of course, you could get even the religious differences. Virginia was based on the Anglican denomination. Rhode Island, of course, had been founded by two heretics, if you will, who were thrown out of Massachusetts Bay, Anne Hutchinson and Roger Williams, and they were both Baptists. So quite a few differences. And you would say, well, given those differences, there should have been some differences that showed up in their militia structures. I mean, in principle, right? And the answer was no. They were line for line, in terms of the principles at least, exactly the same. And that what was interesting, because of course I read the statutes of all of these colonies and independent states, and I found that if you took the titles of them away, because they would often give away which colony it was in the title, and you prescinded, as it were, from some of the language, because the language was a little bit different depending on where you were in the colonies. You couldn't tell one from the other. So this book goes through all that material and comes up with the principles, and then applies those principles today, saying, right, well, what would these institutions look like if we had them today? What would they be capable of doing? Who would be involved in them? What kind of organization, training, equipment, and so forth and so on would you have? And the short answer is, if we had them, we'd have a very highly prepared country to deal with almost any kind of emergency situation you could imagine, from a natural disaster on the one end to a foreign invasion on the other. And I found something very interesting after I wrote the book, several years after I wrote the book. They had this problem in World War II, you know, beginning of the war, or maybe even the late 1930s, 1939, 1940. People began looking at the problem of home defense. What was the United States going to do if we were involved in international wars with the Germans or the Japanese, as it turned out, in terms of the home front?
Right.
And, of course, there was no structure to deal with that. So they put together a committee made up primarily of two of the really bright bulbs in the Franklin Delano Roosevelt era, Fiorello LaGuardia, mayor of New York, and Eleanor Roosevelt, of all people. And they were the kind of the originators of the Committee on what we would call today Homeland Security. And it was fascinating because they came up with all sorts of ideas. They recognized what the basic problem was. There was no organization. There was no training. There was no equipment, blah, 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 on and on you go. There was just nothing there. And they kind of flopped around like fish out of water, trying to come up with a way to deal with this. And it always struck me as interesting that, of course, what they didn't do, which was so typical of the Roosevelt era, they didn't first look into the Constitution.
Right.
Right? If you look into the Constitution, you say, well, here are these organizations, and there are, well, 50 of them now. There's one for each state, militia of the several states, and they are given the authority and responsibility to execute the laws of the Union, suppress insurrections, and repel invasions. So Congress can call them forth for those reasons, and the states are not limited in any way. They can call forth their militia to deal with whatever problems they may have. So if you thought about just those three, you would say, well, my gosh, that's the nucleus of what anyone would consider to be a thoroughgoing homeland security structure, certainly a home defense structure in the course of dealing with possible dangers arising out of international warfare, right? But LaGuardia and Roosevelt and another man by the name of Landis who came afterwards, they were unable to figure this out. And there are a number of books written on this subject, and it's fascinating to see that they don't talk about what we're talking about here now.
The reference to the militias in the Second Amendment, correct?
Yes. The reference is in the Second Amendment, but it's referenced in the original Constitution, too.
Right.
Article 1, Section 8, Clauses 15 and 16, and Article 2, Section 2, Clause 1 makes the president the commander-in-chief of the militia. So Congress has given certain authorities with the militia, and president's made commander-in-chief of the militia, but the militia are recognized as these state institutions, the militia of the several states. They all existed. Now, the Second Amendment comes along, talks about a well-regulated militia being necessary to the security of a free state, and the Second Amendment, just as with every provision of the Bill of Rights, is really a reaffirmation of the proposition that certain authorities or certain powers are not given to the general government, in the original Constitution. What the Bill of Rights is doing is saying, look, you're supposed to read this original Constitution a certain way and apply it a certain way. You're not supposed to misconstrue it, and you're not supposed to abuse it in the wrong manner. And to make sure of that, we're telling you the following: First Amendment, Second Amendment, Third Amendment, so forth and so on. It
right.
isn't as if these powers, there were powers granted in the original Constitution, and there was an amendment in the sense of saying we're taking these away. So if you look at the Second Amendment, and it starts off a well-regulated militia, well, what were they talking about? Well, they were talking about this thing or these things that were in the original Constitution.
Right.
Right? The 14 states at the time, because Vermont had come in. These 14 structures that were in each one of the states under the Constitution. And they make the statement that this is necessary to the security of a free state, which, of course, is essentially an obvious concept because, as the next 14 words tell you, the right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. Well, for what reason? So if they can participate in well-regulated militia for the purpose of generating security for a free state. That's
right.
The structure. So they're kind of just laying it out again in the Second Amendment, the proposition that's given in the original Constitution with respect to Congress's power, at least, call forth the militia to execute the laws, suppress insurrections, repel invasions, which, as I said before, is a pretty good outline of a homeland security thesis, if we wanted to lay it out in those terms. So why don't we have it? Well, of course, they had it at the time of the Constitution's ratification. There were 13 of them, and then immediately 14 of them when the Second Amendment was ratified. They were all there, and anyone who was certainly an adult at that time would have known what these terms, well-regulated militia and militia of the several states, meant, because certainly if he was a man,
right.
he would have served or was at that time serving in those institutions.
So every able-bodied man was required within
uh-huh.
the states
proposition.
To serve.
It was nearly compulsory.
Right.
You had to be able-bodied from 16 on up, and they had age limits as you got into the late 40s, 50s, 60 years of age, which were really predicated on ability. I mean, these were, to a
right.
large extent, paramilitary organizations. You see the concept in most people's minds of, well, they were there at Lexington, they were there at Concord, fighting the British, fighting the French much earlier, so the Indians, of course, French and Indian War. So they were paramilitary organizations. So by the time you got to be 45, 50, 60 years of age, you had arthritis, you had heart condition, you had a lot of these medical conditions that couldn't be cured.
Right.
So you were simply incapable of performing those functions, and of course it would have been unreasonable for any legislature to impose on you that kind of a duty. So every able-bodied free man, because of course they had slaves, the slaves weren't allowed to be in the militia because the second principle of the militia was everyone had to be armed,
right.
unless you were a conscientious objector. And you obviously did not arm the slaves, that was clear. And so everyone had to be armed. And how was he armed? Well, he had to provide for himself. That's usually the term that the statutes use. That every member of the militia had to provide, and then they gave a list of the various arms he had to have. And there might be a musket, long arm, or pistols if you were in the cavalry, and a hatchet, and a sword, blah, 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 on and on and on. And you had to go into the free market and purchase those. So the militia system was predicated on the existence of a rather extensive free market in arms. This wasn't something the government handed out from an arsenal. Now, if you were too poor, they'd find some way in the statute to make sure that you were armed. The town might pay for your arms out of taxes, or the militia might pay for your arms out of the fines that the militia collected. Or they might, in some instance, arrange for you to get a job. But in any event, they made sure that everyone was armed, and then there was a specific set of training requirements. Might come out four times a year, six times a year, and in the course of situations that were crisis-laden, 18 times a year, right? Depending on how much training they needed.
Right.
And then that was a regular operation that you had to conform to. And then there was discipline that was tied into that, obviously, and one element of that discipline is people were fined if they didn't perform these various functions. So, for instance, if you didn't have your complete table of organization and equipment filled out, there was a fine. So many shillings because you didn't have your gun, so many shillings because you didn't have the powder and shot that you required, and so forth down that list. So you had total organization. And the commitment that was involved in this is what's interesting, because, as I said, these were paramilitary organizations, at least paramilitary organizations. They were designed to function alone or in conjunction with whom? The British Army, right? Their army, their imperial army, because the colonies were, of course, part of the British Empire. And if you went off as a militiaman with the British Army to fight the French and the Indians, well, you might be killed or maimed or crippled for life or whatever. So this was not a commitment just to show up and march around, on a parade ground. It was a commitment that might have terminal consequences. And that's because the ethos of the day was, and I suppose should be, in any kind of Republican situation, is that every citizen had a duty to perform some protective function for his community. Right? It goes back to the concept of the ancient Greeks and the ancient Romans, the republic, right? The sovereignty of the people. Well, the sovereignty of the people includes not only rights, but duties as well to the community.
Now, I think it's fair to say during this period, even after the Constitution, you had, if you look at how many people you have on payroll to state and local government whose business is enforcement or safety, you didn't begin to have that infrastructure of governmental employees providing those functions.
Well, they weren't governmental employees.
Right.
But the militiamen were exercising governmental authority.
Right.
All right. So you look at a modern day police force, which is a very small percentage of the community, and it's professional, and it considers itself somehow detached from the community, right? There's the us-them mentality. Well, there's a whole saw that goes when seconds count, the police are only minutes away, right? If you had a militia structure, all of those police entities that we now think of would, of course, become returned to, if you will, subsets of the militia, and there'd be many more people involved in them. Not to mention the fact that you'd have a lot of people, quote unquote, off duty, who would have had the appropriate training to deal with certain police-type situations, right? Street violence, whatever, of one kind or another. This school shooting in Parkland, Virginia, Parkland, Florida, just happened. All of those teachers, all of those administrators, and probably a number of those students, you're talking about a high school, so you'd have students 16 years of age on up, they would have all been members of the militia.
Right.
Unless they qualified for some exemption because they were physically disabled or whatever, they would have been members of the militia and had a very high level of training, and you wouldn't even be talking about whether it would be appropriate to arm the teachers. Of course, they would have been armed.
Right.
Maybe not all of them, but you would have had some rotational duty to make sure that you had armed people, armed and trained people within the school, not outside, as it turned out, hiding behind the cars while the shooting was going on.
Right.
See? So there's a kind of a classic example right there from just, a few weeks ago at most, of the difference between the level of preparedness now and the level of preparedness that the Constitution requires and actually existed at one time way back in the past. And this thing all was, how shall I say, diluted at first and then kind of poured down the drain in 1903. In 1903, Congress passed a statute. It was called the Dick Act because Representative Dick was the original sponsor. And this thing purported to be a reorganization of the militia in the United States. And it created two categories, the organized militia and then the unorganized militia. First it called the reserve militia, and later the statute called it the unorganized militia. And that's what we have today. If you look at any state code that deals with quote-unquote military matters or militia, whatever their title may be, you'll find these two categories, the organized militia and the unorganized militia. The organized militia is the National Guard and the so-called naval militia, which is kind of naval component. So you have the Army National Guard and the Air National Guard, and there's this thing called the naval militia, and that's the organized militia. And then everybody else falls into the category of the unorganized militia. Well, we know the National Guard is pretty highly organized and equipped and trained,
right,
and so forth. And the organized militia is not. It's the exact opposite. You're in this empty set, as it were, in the sense of there's no training, there's no organization, there are no specific duties that are required. Most of the statutes give the governor some kind of emergency power in a, you know, a laundry list of terrible events to call forth people from the unorganized militia. But in Virginia, for instance, the question arises, well, how the heck would he do this? Does he get me on the phone? Does he send somebody around with a bullhorn in a truck? I mean, what does he do? Well, the statute is, you know, empty in terms of that. What training have I had? Well, none. What equipment do I have? Well, none. Right? There's just nothing. So we're in a situation with 300 million people in the country and dealing with all of the potential crisis events that could occur, from natural disasters to industrial accidents, you run down the list. We have to depend either on the National Guard, the training of which is specifically military, or some kind of bureaucratic emergency management agency. And that's, at the present time, FEMA, Federal Emergency Management Agency, there in the Department of Homeland Security. And there are in, I think every state, but certainly most of the states, there are state FEMAs. So we have a Virginia emergency management statute, for instance. And it's interesting that that emergency management statute was tacked on to the end of the military laws of Virginia, where the unorganized militias, whoever wrote that statute, had some vague idea of what this was connected to or what this was supposed to do. And that's why they put it there. But what it amounts to is a plan comes out of Richmond, which, of course, is predicated on a plan that comes out of Washington, and then the capital of Virginia, Richmond. And then Richmond has delegated to all of the subsidiary local governments, whether that's a city government, town government, county government, the authority and the duty to come up with their own plan that's in conformity with this state plan, and then to work out whatever they need to do at their particular local level. So in our county, Warren County, Virginia, which is a kind of semi-rural county, we have a board of supervisors, and they're the ones that have this ultimate authority, and they have delegated that to the fire chief. And so our fire chief is the head of the fire people and the emergency response people. He comes up with a plan, which is basically the state plan, which is basically the FEMA national plan. And we have a little group, like most states have them, called the Community Emergency Response Team, which is the auxiliary for the fire department emergency response people. And the CERT team is designed to mobilize all of the, potentially all of the capable adults in the community. So you can see that somebody has a vague idea that you want, even if you have sort of full-time professionals performing some of these emergency functions, you want to have people out of the general population organized and trained and capable of working with this thin layer of professional EMT people. Right. Well, here in Warren County, we have 33,000, maybe 34,000 people. Say that half of them are adults. That's like 16,000 adults. How many people do we have on the CERT team? Well, on our list, on the paper roster, there's maybe 25 or so. On the number of people who show up to the meetings, that's like 6 or 8. Maybe 10 if we have some particular exercise that we're doing. But let's say we took all of them on the roster, 25 people out of 16,000. That's not much organization. Well, one of the reasons for that is that it's a voluntary organization. You don't have to be a member of the CERT team.
Right.
The FEMA guidelines, if you will, certainly suggest, and go to the website of the Virginia emergency management people, and they have a list of things that people should have in their homes for an emergency. And it's, you know, it's like, almost like a kind of a Boy Scout level. You know, have 3 days worth of food and water. If you need specific medications, make sure that you have enough of those medications to last you for, you know, 3 days, a week, what have you. Blah blah blah, goes on the list. At the end of the list, it says, you know, have paper and pencil so you can write down directives that come over your radio, your battery-powered radio, from the emergency management people. The thing that it doesn't suggest, I think it's fascinating, the thing that it doesn't suggest is that you should have a firearm.
Right.
Right. Well, it should be trained for the possibility that in an extreme emergency, all sorts of social services are going to break down, and you will be very much on your own.
Right. Right.
That ethos is still there, and that was the idea, I think, way back in 1903. They wanted to be able to use the label militia in order to organize people formally into what's become the National Guard, so that they would have this large reserve capacity for the regular armed forces. And that tells you something right away, because the militia can be called forth for only three reasons. By Congress, it can only be called forth for three reasons. Execute the laws, suppress insurrections, repel invasions. Well, going to fight in France or in Guadalcanal, in World War II as an example, doesn't fit into any of those three. Right? So, and the National Guard, of course, was sent to fight in World War I and World War II, Korea, Vietnam, and right. now Afghanistan, Iraq, right? The National Guard was sent overseas to engage in these real wars or these military adventures that we now have. They can't call wars because they don't really qualify as constitutional wars. So what is the National Guard? Well, it can't be the militia. And it isn't the regular army. Well, there is a provision in the Constitution that covers this. It's Article 1, Section 10, Clause 3. No state shall keep troops or ships in time of war without the consent of Congress. Well, that's what's happened here. The National Guard actually falls into this peculiar category of the troops or ships of war that the states may keep in times of peace with the consent of Congress. And the consent of Congress is built into these statutes that began in 1903. So the people who thought this up, they accomplished that. They got this large reserve set up for the Army, and just in time, because World War I came along. You have a series right. of statutes from 1903, 1916, National Defense Act, and then the United States becomes involved in the next year in World War I. So everything was set up exactly in order. And they put everyone else into the unorganized militia for the reason that they didn't want the vast majority of people meddling in government in any way. And the militia, of course, are governmental institutions. They're not private groups. Right. They're authorized by statute to do certain things pursuant to this constitutional mandate. And you remember at that period of time was the beginning of what we call today the administrative state. This was the idea that you really needed in a complex society to have bureaucracies staffed by expert administrators running things. And that Congress's role at the national level was to create these agencies and fund them. And the people's role was to elect the type of congressman who would do that. That was the administrative state structure. And that was going on. You see, the arguments for it were coming out in the law journals and so forth at the turn of the century. And then, of course, it was put into practice in World War I. You had a huge administrative structure that was set up for World War I. But that was essentially temporary. Roosevelt comes along, Franklin Roosevelt, and under the guise of responding to the Depression, he makes this now a permanent structure. Of course, Roosevelt was one of Wilson's people during World War I. He was Assistant Secretary of the Navy, so that's where he learned his business, in the administrative state. And so that's what we have, and it even goes down to this question of Homeland Security preparedness. The directives come out of the experts in Washington, that's FEMA, and then they filter down to the semi-experts and so forth through the state capitals to the various local levels, and then people just respond to these things in a robotic fashion. But they still have maintained this idea that the people really don't fit into this structure in a formal way. All right. We're not going to organize everyone. We're not going to have everyone realize they have some kind of governmental authority that they are exercising. We're certainly not going to make them aware that this structure is a reflection of the concept of Republican form of government, where the people themselves have sovereignty, not some little group of bureaucrats in Washington. We're not going to tell them that. Right. We're going to tell them that they should get, you know, have 3 days' worth of water and so forth and so on. And it's a few of them who will bother to come out. We'll give them a little more training. I mean, the last time I went to a last CERT meeting that we had, we did exercises in dealing with stoppage of blood flow, right? Major incidents of trauma that result in people potentially bleeding to death. How do you deal with that? All right? So that's the kind of thing I would think, in a sense, almost everyone should know about.
Right.
right? Basically, you could run into that kind of situation, automobile accident, right? And a number of other things. So emergency medical preparedness. What do you do if there's some kind of a chemical crisis? I mean, here in this county, we have, I don't know how many trains go through every day, but they're all, everyone I've ever seen is freight train, and they tend always to have some tank cars with hydrochloric acid or whatever. You think of these things that just rolling through here. And, of course, you have derailments all the time throughout the country, and one of those happens. And
one of the funniest videos I've seen in the last 6 weeks or this quarter was an African-American state trooper in New Mexico became a pastor and left the state troopers after a very distinguished career and then decided to start a school. And when the mass school shootings began, he decided that he was going to train some of his teachers to carry and be prepared and have drills with the students. And it shows the students going through the drills and the teachers going through the drills. And, of course, some of these teachers are trained. And not only are they trained, but the training is ongoing. And, you know, he's got all these guys from enforcement helping him. It's very funny. And in comes someone from the teachers, not the teachers at the school, but the State Teacher Association, who is wild with anger that there are experts for this and you cannot teach amateurs to deal with this. You need the experts. And one guy's saying, well, wait a minute, the experts can't get here for 45 minutes. What's your plan? To wait for the experts.
Well, I wonder whom the state teachers union thought was the experts. You know,
right.
I mean, that's all a relative concept. There's no difference. I'm a firearms instructor, have been for 25 years. There's no difficulty in teaching a reasonably intelligent and willing child, 12, 13, 14 years old, the basic rudiments of firearm safety and getting to have some proficiency with different types of firearms, at least that he can physically manipulate. So I can't understand why it would be difficult to imagine that teachers couldn't be taught that. Administrators couldn't be taught that. Especially when you consider the militia structure would start probably before 16 years old.
Right.
16 years old, well, second year in high school. You're probably going back into the middle school because you'd be trying to train these students in terms of, well, here's what's going to happen to you when you become 16 years old. You are now going to have formal duties in this structure that will go on for the rest of your life, assuming that you don't become physically disabled. And so now we're going to tell you at 12, 13, 14, 15 years of age what that's all about, the type of duties that you're going to foresee, that we foresee you having, and we can give you certain kinds of training to prepare you for that so that when you go into the militia at 16, you're not going to be someone who's just a blank sheet of paper, but a lot of useful information is going to have been written in your minds and in your bodies because you'll have had some experience with these things. And one of those, of course, would be, at a minimum, firearms safety. Not necessarily proficiency, that comes later, but safety. Here's a firearm. We want you not to hurt yourself or someone else in manipulating this or dealing with this, right? And that would start very early on, and of course you'd be told, well, why are you going to do this? And we get into the whole concept of Republican form of government, constitutional law, and on and on and on. You think of the avenues that are open there for educating these kids. And by the time you're 16... well, you're out in the field actually doing something, and this is going on a regular basis. Because the militia structure, constitutionally speaking, is not based upon what you learn at the time you're 16 years of age, and that's kind of it. No, you're constantly reviewing this material. Now, it would change over time because from 16 to, probably the late 20s, you're physically, more or less physically capable of performing all sorts of police and paramilitary functions. As you start getting into the 30s and the 40s, well, your ability to do that attenuates. Well, there are other things you can do, right? You can sit in front of a computer. There's an infinite number of things that you can do as you age, not to mention the fact that supposedly as you're aging, you're learning more and more, so now you're capable of taking higher levels of responsibility in the organization. And so some teacher who had been there, who was just hired, for instance, would probably already have spent 7 or 8 years in the militia before that person was even hired to be a secondary school teacher.
Right.
Administrator would have, well, administrator would be typically more years than the teacher, might have been in there for 10 or 15 years in the militia. So the idea that a militia structure would look to any particular form of experts outside of itself is simply a misunderstanding of what that structure is. Because the police, typically, the police department, all these things that we have that are separate now, police departments, sheriff's departments, fire departments, emergency management people, they would all be subsets of the militia in the same way that the Minutemen and the Rangers were in the early days.
Right.
The subsets that they had were less because the particular problems that they were dealing with were less, so they were kind of paramilitary type subsets, but same type of structure. And the reason for this is you don't want the police to think of themselves as separate and independent and maybe antagonistic to the general population. You don't want, right, a mindset in those people of us versus them, the police versus the civilians, as it were. And the only way to stop that is to make them part of the same structure that everybody else is in. Yes, they have different duties, and yes, they may have a different patch on their uniform or whatever, and they're getting paid for this on a regular basis, whereas most militiamen would not be paid simply to come to the training. But that's because they're performing this special militia function, and they have a responsibility to the militia as an organization. So there is no dichotomy between the police on the one hand and the civilians on the other. They're all part of the same structure.
So
that problem would end.
To connect the dots to what you've written about monetary policy, I mean, if you look at the enormous infrastructure of Homeland Security that we've created or police and sheriff enforcement throughout the country, I dare say we could never have printed that much paper unless we'd been the reserve currency, which brings up the question, you know, as the dollar's market share declines, are we going back to a world where the economics will dictate we have to do something like this because we can't afford the edifice that we've built?
Well, we can't afford the edifice for two reasons. The one that you just mentioned, and the other one is that it's so, it doesn't work.
Right.
All right.
It
There's doesn't
that.
Work. The militia structure would require a great deal of participation by people as not volunteers because it's compulsory, but being unpaid.
Right.
All right. Okay, so to make the analogy of the CERT teams again. Yeah, we'd go once a month or twice a month to these meetings, and well, we're not paid now.
Right.
CERT people are volunteers. We're not paid now. Does it really make a difference that we would be in a militia and not paid for doing that? As we're not paid now, except everyone would have to do it.
Right.
And the reason for having everyone do it is you don't know who would be the person on the scene when a particular crisis occurs. Who would be the first responder, right?
Right.
The first responder is always the victim, in a sense. If the victim can respond in some way, the victim is the first responder. And then secondarily, it's whoever happens to be there is potentially the first responder. Our problem today is whoever happens to be there doesn't know up from down with respect to,
right,
the types of problems that he would face in whatever crisis you want to imagine. And he has to call for assistance on 9/11 from whatever those organized structures,
right,
are that are out there.
Right.
Now, friends, in our county, Warren County, we have a very small number of people in the fire and emergency rescue units. And events occur, and one occurred last year, in which every one of those people was on the street dealing with something. And if one more emergency event, if one more heart attack had occurred, right, or one more old person falling down the stairs had occurred, they would have had to wait.
Right.
Because the EMT people, emergency management people that we had, were all out on calls. They would have had to wait, or they would have had to hope that maybe a call could have been put through to one of the neighboring counties and some 9/11 people could have come and dealt with that. Whereas, if you had everyone organized, certainly at a minimum level of understanding of these types of problems, there would have been some people just down the street who could have handled that type of situation.
Okay, so
that's the failure.
If you look at who the equivalent of the militia is here, if we were going to create a militia in Hickory Valley, Tennessee, what we would do, the first thing we would do is we'd call in all the fire department volunteers and try and convert them. So we've had, you know, we have a retired fire chief who moved to Hickory Valley, and he's been organizing these guys for a long time, and he's doing a, you know, it's just a great group of people. But what is happening is the federal government is steadily changing the regulations and rules about how much training they have to do. And if you read and study what's happening, my interpretation is they're trying to drive as many people out of this as possible. They're trying to make it impossible to be a volunteer because you literally can't raise a family, hold down a job, and carry that much training responsibility every year. So everywhere you look, that's just one example. It looks to me like, you know, they're trying to train the general population to be the opposite, completely passive and not trained.
Oh, I think that's right. Yeah, I think that's right. I think that's for two reasons at least. One is just the general mindset of the bureaucracy, right? Top-down control, the all-seeing eye at the top of the apex of the pyramid. We know what's best. You don't. Shut up and do what we tell you, all right?
Right.
And that's bad enough. But the other aspect of that is they don't want people to realize that if you were organized at the bottom of the pyramid, so to speak, then you'd really be in control. They don't want a government of the people, by the people, for the people.
Right.
It's as simple as that. And once people become sufficiently organized, they realize, well, wait a minute, we don't need these directives from Washington because we can handle these situations ourselves. And maybe if we're in a nuclear war or something, we might want to have some help from outside. But most of these situations we can handle ourselves. We don't need those people. Then immediately that whole concept of top-down control from a political point of view dissolves, right? We don't need you. Why do we? Okay, we don't need you. Then why are we going to put up with these constant guidelines and directives and other forms of interference that you're sending down here? Go away, right? Nancy Reagan, just say no. We don't need you. Okay.
Right.
So that's the other side of the coin. And look at a lot of these training programs. I mean, for the CERT people, we have to take some of these FEMA online courses. And they are all about there's a lot of it that's useful, but it could be taught without the other half of it, which is all about bureaucratic structures and organizational diagrams and on it goes. And apparently the most important thing at the bottom line is we'll document all your expenses so that you can, you know, charge these back on the whatever, the state or the federal level. I mean, the whole thing is bureaucracy. And I've spent time with the Navy, so I know about bureaucracy. Naval Laboratory. Even scientists were subject to this kind of bureaucracy. And what it does is, you're right, it drives people away, number one, because they don't want to do it. It's not something that they couldn't do. Most of these courses are something, these certifications that you get are the result of something that you can do online. You can do that in the evenings, and you could do that over a period of time. It's not something that has to be done one afternoon. And then you'll get the certification, and you would have had the whatever level of training was in that particular program. So it's something that people could do. But it's just a pain in the neck to do it. And a lot of it, I mean, I've got notebooks full of this stuff. A lot of it you would never think to use again. What they don't give you, unfortunately, is a lot of hands-on training without the bureaucraties attached to it.
Right.
Right. Let's get some people out in the field every other Saturday or every other Sunday afternoon, and we're going to go through this particular kind of exercise. Here's a mass casualty situation. How do we do triage? How do we set up this? How do we set up that? And the equipment is there, and you go through it. So it becomes second nature to be able to do it. Right. Not looking in some three-ring notebook, you know, 6 months later to see what FEMA told you ought to be done. And that kind of operation obviously could be set up with local people. You don't need people from the state level. You probably certainly don't need people from the federal level to do that. And you would have large numbers of people who were basically adept at doing these things, which ultimately is the only way it's ever going to work, right? It has to be second nature to you. You can't be sitting around thinking how to apply a tourniquet or how to apply a dressing to somebody or how to give them mouth-to-mouth resuscitation or whatever it would be on the, say, emergency medical. You can't be thinking about how you're supposed to deal with a fire, how you're supposed to deal with any of these types of situations that the CERT people go through and get some reasonable training there. And that's our difficulty. And once again, I think it's interesting because it goes back to this mindset of the administrative state or the bureaucratic state is that the people are there to be told what to do and to follow directives and not to take any situation in their own charge, as it were. You don't want, in an administrative state, you don't want the base of the pyramid somehow to feel that it is independent of the upper levels.
Right.
Right? It has to be dependent on that.
Now, let me ask you a jurisdiction question. It seems to me if you were going to revive the malicious structure, you need the state government to do it. You need the state government to be part of organizing and calling for a militia.
Well, that's right, because the Constitution correctly defines these things, the militia of the several states.
Right.
It incorporates that structure. I mean, the federal system is not just Washington, D.C. It's Washington, D.C. and all of the states and then these particular entities.
Right.
Actually, they're the only state entities that are specifically mentioned, other than the legislatures of the states, obviously, the judicial officers of the states, but they're the only entities in the states that are specifically mentioned as part of the constitutional structure. And that goes back to what the Second Amendment says, of course, necessary to the security of free states. You have to have these things. So, yes, they're the state's institutions, and the states have the first responsibility with respect to them.
Right, but the president of the United States can assert authority over them.
If there's a statute that calls them forth, see, Congress has the power to provide for calling forth the militia for three purposes. Execute the laws of the Union, not the laws of the states, but of the Union. Suppress insurrections and repel invasions. And when it calls forth the militia or part of the militia for one or more of those purposes, then the militia are, as the Constitution says, employed in the service of the United States, recognizing that they are something outside of the United States government. They are part of the state.
Right.
And the president is given the authority as commander-in-chief of the militia of the several states when called into the actual service of the United States. That's the constitutional language. Right? So the president has this authority under those circumstances and only when those circumstances actually obtain. It's interesting that word actual appears only there.
Right.
With respect to the militia. And the reason for that was, well, they were worried about any kind of centralized authority over military or quasi-military institutions. And they certainly didn't want the President of the United States, who was also the Commander-in-Chief of the regular Army and Navy, to the extent Congress created those things, they didn't want him to be able to exercise some control over the militia that didn't have limitations, because then he would have in his own hands all of the military and paramilitary power of the entire country.
So he could do this when
the militia are called forth, but that depends upon a statute from Congress, and it has to be the actual service. He can't just be bluffing here. So the militia could say to him, no, this isn't the actual service. You're calling us up to go fight in France. We're not going.
Right.
All right.
But is there a theoretical issue here where the militia could be looked at to overrule the sheriff in terms of federal versus local jurisdiction? If the sheriff or the state government says, no, you know, the feds can't do that here, can the militia in theory be used to overrule?
Well, then you'd run into exactly this conflict problem that always arises in federalism. All right. If the quote-unquote superior body attempts to assert powers that don't exist, is usurping powers with respect to the inferior body, that is, Congress is attempting to, or the president, or Congress and the president are attempting to usurp powers with respect to the states, then you have the doctrine of interposition. The states are supposed to say no.
Right.
You know, that you don't have that constitutional authority. Oh, and by the way, Mr. President, we have 7,295,000 people in our state militia. That's a big state. Who are going to go along with this, all right? So we have a problem. And that's exactly the point. It's a pushback, all right?
Right.
The system is like a bunch of elastic bands all connected to various points. And if you pull on one too much, the others are going to pull in the opposite direction, and that's what's supposed to happen. There's supposed to be this kind of tension. But the tension depends upon the existence of these other institutions that can function in that way. If you don't have state militia, under the structure that we have now, you don't. It's a paper thing. Then there is no pushback. Right? The federal government can say, well, this is what you're going to do, Sheriff,
right,
such and such. And you have two deputies, and we'll send down, 25 FBI agents to require you to do this.
Right. It's not just the organization, though. It's the culture.
It's a recognition by people at the base of the pyramid that the strength of any pyramid is in the base, it is not in the apex.
Right.
See, we've been taught the opposite. That all the strength and wisdom and so forth is up there with the all-seeing eye at the top of the pyramid, and that filters down through the states eventually to Ma and Pa Kettle at the local level. Right? The average American, the people that Hillary Clinton called the deplorables. Right? We're not as smart. We're not as energetic. We don't have the experience. But whatever the heck it is that defines being deplorable, we're it. All right?
And we did you hear the latest? I don't know if you know it, but the reason I voted for Trump is the men around me told me to do it.
Oh, yeah, that's right. We bought the excuse. All right.
I don't know my own mind.
Yeah. But you know, whatever word she wants to apply to us, that's a direct contradiction. It's kind of the antithesis of the concept of Republican form of government. The Republican form of government is based on sovereignty of the people, not sovereignty of some group of elitists from New York City or Los Angeles or wherever that are going to tell everyone else what to do.
All right.
Now, that requires institutional structures, and we have them in the Constitution, except for the reality that the militia, the ultimate power in any state is the power of force. What is it Washington said? Government is not eloquence. Government is force.
Right.
If you're incapable of exercising force, you really don't have any kind of sovereign authority in that particular area.
Right.
So here we have these structures that the Constitution itself, Second Amendment, for the security of a free state, and they are moribund. And it's not surprising then that we don't have a free state anymore in any one of the 50. Because these basic structures in which people would participate with the realization that they were doing this for a particular purpose. It wasn't just because they wanted to go out on a warm Saturday afternoon, you know, and play soldier on the green or whatever,
right,
you know, training they'd be doing that afternoon. They were functioning in this organization in order to exercise the actual sovereignty that they're supposed to exercise in a Republican form of government and therefore to maintain that form of government. So as you say, it's a cultural problem. And people were weaned off of this concept. How? By taking them out of the operation. If you don't go to these meetings, if the militia structure required a certain number of training sessions, so if you don't participate in it, pretty soon you lose any kind of intellectual contact with it at all. You know, it's a historical thing. Oh, that happened way back when. That was going on in the 1800s, late 1800s. But it's not relevant to us today. Why? Because I don't participate in it. No one's telling me to do this.
Edwin, let me ask you one question. Is that if a state decided to call for a militia or to organize their militia, is there anything in the law that would prevent them from having it be coeducational?
No. No. The militia structure in the colonial period was based upon men only, able-bodied, adult, free men only, because the position of women was culturally and legally such that people, including the women, I imagine, didn't want to participate in it. It was a paramilitary organization. It was going out to fight the French and the Indians, for heaven's sake. Right? That was its primary function. So the women didn't participate in it directly. Now, the women participated in it indirectly in the sense that Every able-bodied male had to have a firearm. So what happened if you were a minor? Okay, you could be. From 16 to 21, you could be in the militia. You could be living at home. You had no income, for instance. Or maybe you were an apprentice or a servant of some kind. Where you would have, whatever age you were, you probably would have no direct income. You were getting room and board and training. Well, what happened in those situations was that the family, the father or the master of the apprentice, had to pay. It was his responsibility to pay for the minor child or the apprentice. Well, what happens if now it was a widow that was in charge of this situation, a widowed woman with, you know, several male children? She was financially responsible.
Mm-hmm.
She had to pay. So the women had responsibility in that. Now, obviously, the legal status of women has changed. They're no longer legally subject to their fathers or their husbands. And there are plenty of things that they could do in a proper militia structure. I personally would not like to see them out, you know, integrated in the front line of the 20 to 25-year-old people who are getting the, you know, basic Army and Marine Corps-type training. Right? I can't see a civilized society that really does that, except in the last ditch, right?
Right.
Right?
Right.
You're invaded.
Stalingrad.
This is our last hope. Well, then they will have had that training. But normally they would not be called for that particular duty. There'd be something else that they would do. So they would all fit in. My point with this is everyone in the society would fit in some way. You wouldn't all necessarily do the same things.
Right.
But you'd all be trained basically to do kind of a potpourri of basic
things. Well, in fact, almost everybody can participate in a variety of different ways.
Yeah, and then you give people specialized training depending on what their interests were. Our situation is so much better than the colonial situation. They had a limited number of people and a large number of problems. We have an unlimited number of people relative to the problems.
Right. Well, as long as, if we should lose reserve currency status tomorrow,
let me give you an example of that.
The problems are going to skyrocket.
Yeah, but let me give you an example. Say you were facing that problem. You say, the monetary system is going to break down. So we need to begin thinking about an alternative currency. Well, if you had a militia structure, you could do what the state of Texas has done. It has a gold-silver depository. And I understand that they're going to set that up in such a way that it can be used as a gold-silver bank, that people can actually hold their gold and silver there and make transactions through the depository. And you say, well, that's a fine idea. And I say, well, we need to add something to that. We need that depository to be under the control of the militia.
Right.
Because we don't want a 1933 type event occurring again where the federal people in Washington decide we're going to confiscate all the gold. They come down and attempt to confiscate it. It has to be protected. And then the second thing is you want people in the state to be able to use that, not just to hear about it. So you would tell all the people in the militia, here's part of your militia duty. The security of free state includes the economic security of free state. Part of your militia duty is you have to get an account in our depository so that you are capable of using this alternative currency. And whether you use it or not, at this stage, is up to you. We're not going to force you to use it. But we are going to require you to have an account in the same way we could maybe require you to have some kind of credit card or the deposit card, whatever the hell it would be, however the heck it would work. You're going to be required to do that. So you are capable of using this system. And then we're going to go to all the businessmen, because all of those people would also be members of the militia. And we're going to say, as part of your militia duty in your business or profession, you are required to post an alternative set of prices. So you're selling these particular products, and here's a list of the prices in U.S. dollars, so-called, and we want an alternative list of prices in gold and silver. And we'll give you, we'll tie you into whatever databases are necessary so that you can come up with these numbers, and you're doing it all by barcodes anyway. So, we'll give you the IT materials that you need. But you're going to set this up so that you could, if you wanted to, with your customers, make a gold and silver transaction. You could operate outside of the dollar nexus and make a gold and silver transaction. Once again, we're not going to require you to do this, but if you choose to do it with your customers, that's fine, and we want you to be able to do that with your customers. Well, now, imagine you could set that up at the click of the fingers.
Right.
At that point, given that everyone in the society from 16 on up is part of the militia, you could walk away from the Federal Reserve System right then and there.
Exactly, which is why they don't want it happening.
You got it. And it's not just the monetary system. But you see, there's an example, a modern example of the use of the militia that would directly impact us with respect to this looming problem.
So I think that the thing that I want to really communicate and encourage people to get the sword and sovereignty is to understand that money and force need to get tied at the hip. In other words, you have to have the ability to enforce if you want to deal with or re-engineer money. And so if we're going to, whether it's we're changing what's happening with the currency or we're going to require the federal government to obey the law related to finances, you have to deal with the gun ownership issue. And I think it's one of the reasons the bankers are trying so hard to remove gun ownership from the population is because they know these changes are coming and they want to make sure that the population does not have the ability to enforce the law when they come.
Well, enforce the law in the really broad sense, too, in terms of self-defense.
Right.
We think people like the NRA say, well, gun ownership is important for self-defense. What they leave out of the equation is self-defense is the foundational element of law.
Right. Right.
Self-defense is your exercising the law against an aggressor who's attacking you under circumstances in which nobody else is there, the police or whatever, courts or whatever, are there to assist you. You are the executor of the law at that point. Now,
right.
If you aren't justified, the law can come back and say, well, you shouldn't have done that. Right? You really were not imminently threatened. But assuming that the circumstances are correct, you are the law at that point.
Right.
And, of course, that's the first responsibility of the militia, to execute the laws. So everyone who is in that situation, being armed on the street or in his home to protect against an aggressor, is in fact preparing to, or will be, under those circumstances, executing the law. You are the
right.
law. You
right.
are, as it were, the government at that point in time.
Right.
And if people would simply extrapolate from that and say, well, yeah, that's true there, and what about all these other areas that we can inject the militia into? I mean, money is one example. All of the protective functions that we now have, police, fire, emergency management, emergency response, et cetera, all of that. One of the things I like to point out to people is you'd never have a fraudulent election if you had a militia structure, because everyone who would be eligible to vote from 18 years on up, where would he vote? Well, people vote in their local precincts or whatever, right, which is the areas around which the militia would be structured, right? The militia would be structured upon your local political structure.
Right, although if you still had computer voting, of course they could.
Well, you get rid of that. You see, you'd have so many
right.
people that you could go back to the paper ballot. And what
right.
I like to say to people is, well, you'd have these paper ballots, and they'd be, you know, what do they call them? The carbons, where you have multi copies. And so there'd be three copies. So take a simple example. The ballot would have three copies. The top one would go to the, you'd mark this up, and you'd hand it, and they'd all have serial numbers, and you'd mark this up to whatever it was, and then you'd drop it in the box, and you'd take the second one, and you'd drop that in a separate box, and you'd take the third one home. And there would be two counts, and you know, multiple counts with each one out of those two boxes. And then they would report at your polling place a list of all the serial numbers of the ballots and what the vote was for that serial number. Was it for Jones? Was it for
right,
Smith?
We
was
could
it
check.
In favor of the referendum or against? And
right.
so you could come in with your own ballot and look it up. Oh, my ballot is 2792. Yeah, they got it right. Or they got it wrong. And if they got it wrong, then I think you would probably ask that, you know, there'd be a process by which you could be corrected. And there would be all the ballots, and there would be the total. And it would all
right.
have been checked and double-checked by militia people who were brought in for that particular election on rotation. So you wouldn't have a standard group of you know, poll watchers or vote counters. So there'd be no way to corrupt these people because you wouldn't know who they were.
Right.
Until a week or so before the election happened, right?
Right.
So you have your honest election, this election fraud would disappear overnight.
Right.
Right.
I agree.
And you can think of the one that I like best is exemptions were given in the constitutional militia for certain people. And in the group that normally had exemptions were people who had political office. You didn't want to bring in the legislators. You didn't want to bring in the judges. And the idea was if they were performing a function that was so important to the community, that we didn't want to take them away from that function and make them come to all the training sessions. That probably didn't mean much because in a real crisis, a lot of those people turned out to be officers in the militia, but leave that aside. That was the reason that we put them there, that they were performing this important function and therefore they could be exempted. Well, the contrary of that is, what if they fall down on that function? What if they turn out to be corrupt? What if they turn out to be whatever, you know, part of the deep state, and this comes to the fore, like Mr. McCabe, right? What happens at that point? Well, then they've lost their right to be exempted, and they can be pulled back into their normal militia duty. And
mm-hmm.
it would be appropriate for their normal militia unit to be capable of quizzing them every now and then as to the extent to which they are performing their function. So you would have these town hall sessions would be going on all the time, but they wouldn't simply be hot air passing back and forth from the elected official to the people that are in the audience. They would be a kind of inquisition of this person as to what he had been doing and whether this was proper. And if it wasn't, they'd pull his exemption.
Right.
All right? Now he'd be subject to militia discipline. Oh, I love that particular picture. because you would have real control and responsibility at the local level. These people could not simply go off to the county or the state or the national government, whatever level, and then thumb their nose at their constituents for the next 2 years or 4 years or 6 years or whatever it was. Because they could be called in at any time and say, what the hell have you been doing? We've got this kind of information about you. Well, this kind of information, you have to justify what you'll be doing to us in our local militia organization, because the only reason you have an exemption from our local militia organization is because you're performing this political function properly. So we always have the right to question you about this, and you have the requirement to answer us.
Right.
See? Which is not true at the town hall.
So there are two things I want to bring up before we close. One, I don't know if you saw this, but 2 weeks ago, a General Neller of the Marine Corps was testifying in front of Congress and was being asked about recruiting. Mm-hmm. And he pointed out that one of their challenges was of the population age, of the age that's recruited from that cohort in the population, only 30% were eligible for physical, moral, or emotional reasons to join the Marines. 70% were ineligible for physical, moral, or emotional reasons.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And where does that go back to, the school system?
Well, I would say it goes back to both food, health, and school.
Well, initially, that's right, because obviously if someone comes into school and they have a health problem or nutritional problem, that has to be corrected. So there are other sources of it. But let's take someone in the schools. How much physical education do they get? How much information are they given as to, you know, proper nutrition? Are they even being prepared for this function? I mean,
You're intentionally creating a population which is hopelessly dependent.
Well, that's right. That's right. So here's kind of your classic example of the problem. Nobody questions, I suppose, the existence of the regular armed forces, including the Marine Corps. Right? And nobody questions the idea that they should be able to draw people, voluntarily at least, from society who could function, you know, under their training regime. And here's the reality. Well, 70% of them, whatever that number is, very large number, can't. Right? And go back to this cultural problem that we have. Because I would think that even leaving aside the militia question, you'd be training people in the schools and otherwise to recognize, wait a minute, some of you at least are going to want to go into the armed forces. And a lot of you were going to need to go into the armed forces, whether you really want it or not. We're going to encourage you to volunteer. And my God, if we had a real war, we'd have to get you in there one way or the other, right, to defend the country. You really have some kind of responsibility. You teachers, you administrators, at least have some kind of responsibility in that respect. And, of course, if you look at the National Education Association as an example, what is their ethos about these matters? What are they proposing? Well, this is the last thing that they'd ever be in favor of.
Right?
Because it's teachers' unions. Okay? And public schools are bad enough without teachers' unions, but the vast majority of people who send their children to public schools have no conception of what the teachers' unions are doing. See, it really goes back to the average person. The average person has been thoroughly dumbed down and intellectually at least removed from any connection to the concepts that inform our constitutional type of government.
Right.
If you ask the average person what a Republican form of government is, he would say, I don't like that because I'm a Democrat.
Let me ask you one other question. One of the most interesting books I ever read about American politics was a book called Harvest of Rage. I don't know if you've read it. It's by a gentleman named Joel Dyer, and it was literally about how how the bankers set up a huge number of farmers in the late 70s, early 80s. Essentially what they did is they encouraged them to take on a huge amount of debt through the farmer program, you know, the farmer's home. Then Volcker ran the interest rates up enormously, and then they pulled the subsidies. And of course, a lot of them defaulted, and then they brought the IRS in and announced they had to pay taxes for forgiveness of indebtedness. And the next thing you know, all these farmers get together and organize groups that they call militias, which aren't the militia under the Constitution, but they use the name. And then they send in the FBI and do an enormous amount of COINTELPRO kind of activities. And one of the things they tried to do was absolutely destroy the word militia in the minds of the American people.
Oh, yeah.
And I always wondered if literally that wasn't a plan, because the one thing they never wanted to see was the militia concept rejuvenated.
Yeah, well, as I said, going back to 1903,
right.
I mean, they created this false label. I'm not against the National Guard, but it's operating under a false label. It is not a militia. No question,
right.
The National Guard is not a militia. But they said, well, the National Guard is a militia, and everyone else is in this other thing called the unorganized militia, which by hypothesis didn't do anything. There was nothing for it to do because the statute didn't come up with a list of things to do, as opposed to the National Guard, of course, which is highly organized and has all sorts of statutory structure and responsibilities. And that was the first step. So now we could tell people, oh, well, sure, we have a militia. It's over here. It's called the National Guard. It has a special name. And the rest of you don't have to worry about that. You're in the unorganized militia. If something really turns up, you know, we can always call on you.
So here's the most important question. The bankers seem to have enough money to buy all the best lawyers except for you. What happened to you?
they didn't make me an offer. I mean, you know, an offer you can't refuse. That's a theory in our society, right? If it's big enough. Listen, our society is based on, you know, if you look at this from a musical point of view, our society is based on two notes only. Do, 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 and me, me, me. If there's no way for me to get do, I'm not interested in it, right? That's a theory of the way people operate. So they buy
that's
people
not,
off.
Not everybody.
Not everybody. But, you know, in my case, I guess they figured that I was talking about things that were so esoteric with respect to the average person that no one would really pay attention. It wasn't worth trying to buy me off. Save the money. He's not going to get anywhere with this. And they've been successful, certainly with the militia, with the money concept, for instance. I mean, who questions,
right.
You know, Federal Reserve notes? Because that's the money, gold and silver, something different, something you wear on your finger, around your neck, but that's not money. And then the militia concept, they had to demonize that. And they were very effective because the National Rifle Association, a classic example of this, in their bylaws, the National Rifle Association says, we are in business, for one of the purposes is to train people so they can perform their militia functions. That's in the NRA bylaws. And the NRA, of course, was set up to train people for the use of arms after the Civil War by some Union generals because their experience was that a lot of Northern individuals, at least Northern citizens, came into the Union forces and they didn't know which end of the rifle to point at the Southern boys, right? So they created the NRA, and that was the NRA's purpose, still is the NRA's purpose. And when the NRA became really involved in opposing gun control, that was in the early 1970s, they finally set up a lobbying group, the Institute for Legislative Action, I guess they call it, the ILA, specifically for the purpose of opposing gun control. They were very careful not to talk about militia, and they still are. They focused on this concept of the individual right to have a gun so that ultimately you could protect yourself.
Right.
And in the background, there was always the subtext, if you will, of, well, you know, it's also to protect people against, or society against tyranny, because Lexington and Concord and that whole historical picture that people would have. And the thing I've always asked people in the NRA was, well, do you really believe that an individual by himself in his cellar, even if he has an AR-15 rifle and 1,000 rounds of ammunition, he's going to be able to defend himself against an organized tyranny made up of hundreds and hundreds of, you know, kill-crazy SWAT members or whatever that will come looking for him? Well, of course, the answer is no. It's an impossibility. All right? You have to have an organized structure to oppose tyranny because all tyrants come at you with an organized structure or they're not worthy of the name tyrant. Right? So the NRA has been very careful not to become involved with the militia concept. And I think that was because even during the Kennedy administration, and I remember this, I was old enough at the time to be paying attention, a number of people said that the Kennedy administration had basically subversives in the high level. There were a lot of people who were in favor of socialism and so forth and so on. Kennedy administration was loaded with these people. And a group started, I think it was out in Montana, in the West someplace, called the Minutemen. And they claimed to be some kind of militia. And they got themselves in various kinds of trouble because they were they were truly an extremist group, if you can use that term. And so the concept militia was getting a pretty bad name in the media at that point in time. This was the early 1960s. Right? And then by the time the NRA became active in the 70s, of course, that concept had been thoroughly demonized. And subsequently, it's been even more demonized. Southern Poverty Law Center is a classic example of one of the centers of this demonization. Anyone that talks about militia, oh, he's an extremist, he's a dangerous this, that, or whatever. I mean, they have all sorts of names for you. And, of course, they don't talk about the constitutional aspect of this. And it's fascinating because if that's true, if to be a proponent of the militia is somehow out of bounds, well, then the whole structure of the Constitution is out of bounds.
Right.
I didn't invent this. You didn't invent this.
Right.
It's right there in the Constitution. And it's a requirement in the Constitution because the militia of the several states is not optional.
Right.
It's no more optional than Congress is optional, the president is optional, or the states themselves are optional. You're supposed to have this, and that's why the Second Amendment talks about it being necessary to the security of a free state. Right? It's reiterating in slightly different language the structure that's already given in the original Constitution. So you would think that anyone who looks at the Constitution with, I don't know, a modicum of understanding
notice
of the English language would say, we've got a problem here.
You're right. Exactly.
All right? And then you can assert, you know, give responsibility. Who's responsible for this problem? And you can go back to 1903, you can, whatever you want to say. But we have a problem. And this problem is a very serious one because the militia structures were intended to be there to deal with a whole host of other problems.
Well, our current form of government requires significant participation by the general population, which is not happening.
Yeah, well, that's right. It's Article 4, Section 4. The United States shall guarantee to every state in this union a republican form of government. What is a republican form of government? It's a government in which not simply the people vote for representatives, as opposed to a direct democracy, but it's a people, it's a government in which the people exercise sovereignty themselves. They don't have somebody exercising sovereignty over them. And Mao Zedong, as much as, you know, he's a butcher and a madman, he does crystallize the idea in a single aphorism: political power grows out of the barrel of a gun.
Right.
That's the reality of government. Government is force in the final analysis. And then you ask, well, the sovereign is the entity or the person or the thing, whatever, that holds this political power in his hands, holds the political power that grows out of the barrel of a gun in his hands. If the people are the sovereigns, they are the ones that control the guns ultimately. If some bureaucrat in Washington is the sovereign, then he controls it, his little group controls it.
Right.
And that's the essential difference in government throughout history. Is it some little group that in one way or another is going to tyrannize, or is it more or less the people in society who are going to have control?
Can I ask you a wild card question that may or may not relate to this?
Sure.
President Trump, in late December, issued a executive order, and then on March 1st, a presidential action. The December executive order was on persons involved in human trafficking and on various rights to seize and do other things in effect with stopping this. And then the presidential action related to the conduct of military tribunals envisioned under the first. Do you have any opinion on what exactly that procedure is and what it's for?
No, but I can't imagine how he thinks he can do this through military tribunals. I mean, take international drug trafficking or international trafficking in children or whatever, which is worse, I suppose. These are criminal entities, criminal organizations that are doing it. They're not, in most instances, as far as I know, they're not state actors. There isn't some division in the Chinese government that's involved with human trafficking. These are international criminal organizations, private criminal organizations. Well, by hypothesis, they can't be touched by the United States military. I mean, I suppose you can have the Coast Guard. My son is in the Coast Guard, and he did a tour down the Caribbean. going all the way down to Venezuela, looking for potential drug traffickers on the high seas. All right. So there are some aspects of that. But assume that he caught one of those, or his ship caught one of those people. Well, they have to be turned over to the civil authorities in whatever jurisdiction they were closest to.
Right. All right.
It's not something that's going to be sent to military tribunals. This is this crazy idea that came out of 9/11 and the Authorization for Force Act, and the National Defense Act, that somehow or other we can categorize people as enemy combatants, and therefore they can be subject to military law, to martial law. And that's complete nonsense, complete nonsense. So I don't know what he's doing there. What he could do, the entities that have the authority to execute the laws of the Union, what are they? Well, it's not the Army, not the Navy, or the Marines or the Air Force. It's the militia.
Right.
If he wanted to, deal with trafficking within the United States, well, there's the entity that can handle it. Of course, they're not there, right? They don't, we don't have that structure, but that's the entity that can handle
right.
it. And it would be appropriate, too, because where does the trafficking begin? Not only in, but where does it begin? Well, usually they're kidnapping someone, right? They're stealing someone or luring someone into the child prostitution or child pornography, whatever it is, which happens at the local level. All these things happen at the local level to begin with, and that's where you're initially going to look into it. So if he were doing that, I would say, okay, you're using the right entities, and the militia would not be the ones doing the trying of these people. They would do the apprehending, the investigation and the apprehending, and then turn them over to the civil courts, obviously. But they would be executing the laws in the same way the president could execute the laws, by investigation and apprehension, indictment, right? And then the courts would handle it. And Congress has actually passed a couple of statutes that would probably allow the president to do this. I think of Title 10 of the United States Code, Section 252, is probably a good one. Gives them the authority to call forth the militia when there are conspiracies, combinations, and so forth. It's got a kind of laundry list that the normal judicial process can't handle, which is just what we have here, basically, right. In those areas. We have exactly that. And we certainly, the normal police process can't handle it either, because we don't have enough police to do it. So if we had a properly organized militia structure, we'd have many, many more people who would be trained to deal with that, and the more eyes on the street at the local level, the less that traffic is going to be able to succeed. It all comes down to that. You know, as I said before, the first responder is who? Is the victim.
It's the victim, right.
Right? Or the person that's standing next to the victim, the person that's right there, right? It's not somebody coming in after the fact. So these trafficking networks, whether they're dealing with people or they're dealing with drugs, they're all happening ultimately at the very local level, and that's where the eyes have to be, focused.
Well, I live in a county that has a fabulous sheriff, but it's still, 5 to 45 minutes before the sheriff can get to us. So we're all trained. We're all trained that for at least 45 minutes, we're on our own, and it's our job to take care of it, whatever it is.
Yeah, well, there you have it. I mean, that's the reality for everybody. Maybe it isn't 45 minutes, but it's some unfortunately long length of time.
Right, right. Well, I think that's one of the things I want to impress on everybody listening to this, is that first 45 minutes belongs to you and your neighbors and your community, and that's the question for you. What are you going to do? How are you going to deal with it? Edwin, could you explain to people how they can get a copy of the book?
Well, as in almost all dealings with books these days, you can go to Amazon, amazon.com. The Sword and Sovereignty is actually a CD. It was too long, too expensive to produce in a book. But that's good on the other side, because it's searchable. It's a PDF format, and so you want to find some particular aspect of it, you can search it very easily. And there are a number of shorter books. That one, Sword and Sovereignty, is over 2,000 pages long. I have a book called 13 Words, which focuses on the first clause in the Second Amendment, why that is the important one. I have one called Three Rights, which ties the Declaration of Independence into the Constitution, with specific emphasis on the Second Amendment and militia clauses. And then I have one that may be very timely, called By Tyranny Out of Necessity, The Bastardy of Martial Law, which goes into great detail on the concept of what I call the anti-concept of martial law. Martial law is not something that is allowed by the Constitution of the United States. And we've seen more and more of the martial law concept being insinuated into the statutory laws, at least, since the 9/11 event, especially with the National Defense Act. And the concept we were just talking about, of military tribunals and people who are declared to be enemy combatants and all the Guantanamo and torture and all the rest of that nonsense that's been going on. And that is a really dangerous concept because, as my book points out, once you get into martial law, you realize that martial law is something that is, totally extra-constitutional.
Right.
There are really no constitutional restraints once you allow it, once you accept that concept. There are no constitutional constraints on what can be done under martial law. So the very fact that you have people in Washington, D.C. who have been capable of insinuating this thing into various statutes tells us we are way down the road to the worst kind of tyranny.
Right. Right. Well, I think that the thing that helps us get down that road is if you have a population that is completely dependent.
Well, that's right. They're dependent every way, especially intellectually dependent.
Right.
Right. This, when I started writing this, I realized this isn't something that is inaccessible to even the average person. Right? You might not find it at your local library, but you could ask a librarian to get you an interlibrary loan of the necessary book that you had to read, or books that you had to read.
Right. All right.
You don't have to go to Harvard Law School, which I did, to understand this.
Right.
It is not that arcane, really. But people are not taught anything about this. Especially now. I go into high schools and listen to their, social science classes or whatever. But I imagine if the word militia comes up in the context of secondary education in this country, it is discussed only to be demonized. I can't imagine secondary school where the teacher would say, well, now we're going to discuss the militia, and let's start off with the militia statutes in the states, and let's go through all what I do in my books. I can't imagine them doing that. I would say, well, militia, they would just simply say, well, militia, a bunch of extremists. They're crazy people running around with camouflage outfits, guns in the woods. You don't want to be connected with
those.
You
sound just like a banker.
They're trained with guns, right? They have guns, right? That would be the line. So at that, what I would call the most primitive level, from the point of view of political science, given the Second Amendment's connection of a well-regulated militia as necessary to the security of a free state, just given that, we are in big trouble.
One of my favorite moments during the last year was when Stephen Wilford, former NRA rifle instructor, went out, got his assault rifle, stopped church shooting, and then proceeded to refuse to talk to the corporate media, would only talk to the independent media. And so, in fact, the honest story got out, and I said, okay, well, we're getting smarter. Now, so last question, could you tell everybody how to find your website and how they should reach you, get in contact with you?
Well, my website is just edwinviera.com. That's what I would call a storage site for the various things I've written over the years that are on the Internet. I have posted most of that stuff on a website called News with Views, one word, newswithviews.com. It goes back all the way to, 2005 or something when I started putting things up. And the edwinviera.com site is pretty much a mirror of what's on News with Views. I have a few things that were too long or too complicated to put up on News with Views, so that they're separate on my own website. They can go there. They can contact me at edwinviera@gmail.com. That's simple enough.
Okay. Well, Dr. Edwin Viera, I think you're a national treasure.
Well, I'm a hidden treasure. Yeah, I'm a hidden treasure. I'm like the Ark of the Covenant. It's in the box there somewhere in storage.
About to get less hidden, I think. I think these issues are coming to the fore. And my prediction is about to be less hidden. So I think all of the work that you've done makes it much easier for someone like me, someone like the people listening to this, to sort of grab hold of the information. Your work has made it much more accessible, much faster. And the time is coming when we need it now, but it's definitely coming when we're going to need it. So, Dr. Viera, on behalf of all of us, thank you so much for everything that you've been doing and that you're doing and I know will do. So
I forgive you.
You're the only person with 4 degrees from Harvard that I've ever said nice things about.
Well, I hope that has more to do with me than with Harvard.
No, it definitely has very much to do with you. So anyway, thank you again for joining us on the Salieri Report.
Okay. Thank you, Kevin. Take care.